podcast from Kara FE.
I'm Paul.
And I'm Jesse.
And I'm Jacob.
And fifth grade at St. Jude's School.
True that. True that.
For CJLO News, I'm Daniel Braz. In an email to its users, Bixi has announced that the rate to rent their bikes will increase as of Friday.
Sits on the traditional territory of the Mohawk or the Ganegahaga people. The island called Montreal is known as Dardake in the language of Ganegaha and has historically been a meeting place for other indigenous nations, including the Algonquin people.
Good morning, Montreal. This is the Get Up on CJLO 1690 AM with your host, Julia Israel. Unfortunately for us this week, Lure is not here, but I will be filling in for the both of us. But to celebrate, it is the 1st of March. We got a lot of things lined up for this month. We've got International Women's Day next week. We have daylight savings, the internal confusion. We got Ramadan, Purim, Easter, and we can't forget the spring equinox, the most high, the most religious, of course, for some. Also, today is my lovely friend Rena's birthday. Rena, if you're awake right now, give me a shout, call into the studio. Happy birthday. Let's get into the weather. It's currently -8 and sunny in Montreal, but it feels like -12. We'll get a high up to +3 degrees this afternoon. We might get some clouds midday, so just make sure you get your sun in this morning. Wind gusts up to 20 kilometers per hour today. Grab your jacket, your gloves, your hat, whatever you need to stay warm out there. The bad news is there's no snow on the ground, unless that's a good thing for you. And how about some traffic? Today there's a standstill in Lachine where the 13 meets the 20. A bit of build-up eastward on the 40 until DeCary. Otherwise, the bridges are open and we've got no major road closures today, so just drive safe. And by the way, as we always say every week, if you want to call into the studio, tell us about your missed connections, funny story, any shout-outs, call us. 514-848-7471. Call into the studio. Let's have a chat. Now we got some news today. The Front commun has agreed to a tentative deal reached with Quebec. Katie Brady has the story for us.
Aujourd'hui, le Front commun tourne la page des négociations intersectorielles.
Common Front leaders thanked its members and the public last Friday as they confirmed adoption of the tentative deal reached with Quebec late last year. The new five-year contract promises a 17.4% pay hike and an inflation safeguard. Cameron Campbell works at Dawson College in Montreal. He's not one of the 74% of Common Front union members who voted to adopt the agreement in principle.
I think that the general view was that I asked, can we get more out of these idiots question, politer than that, but that's what I asked. The general consensus was no, there was no more to get.
But he told CJLO it'll do for now.
The interest rate for our last year of our contract was 4 and a bit, and the interest rate for the year before was 6, almost 7, and then so far we're cruising at 2 point whatever. And so when we sign, we're already going to be like 4 in the hole, at least. So it's just, I don't know, the money part annoys me. But I don't think there was any more money to get. It's hard to tell people that aren't getting a raise or aren't doing well or having a hard time affording food that, like, you know, we should have gotten more than 17 point whatever percent. But by the same token, when you divide it by 5, it starts looking kind of crap.
Campbell thinks the deal has elements which have potential to benefit other CEGEP support staff and students. He's happy to see that tradespeople and mental health professionals within his school will now get paid the same as their counterparts outside of CEGEPs. But he joins others in their frustration at Premier Legault's recent budget remarks.
I set aside my political views about him, and I come down to competency, and I just don't think he's very good. I disagree with almost everything that he thinks and says, but at the bare minimum, I'd like him to be able to count. It's willful, right? I mean, it's for political purposes.
Meanwhile, other public sector unions outside of the Common Front are growing frustrated. The SPGQ, Union of Government Workers in Quebec, have asked for a conciliator to step in and say strikes aren't out of the question for its 24,000 members. For the full interview with Cameron Campbell, check out CJLO's News Roundup on Spotify. In Montreal for CJLO, I'm Katie Brady.
And we got another one coming up next from Katie Brady. The final night of Black History Month was celebrated last night with a Haitian dance lesson night in Côte-de-Neige. Here's the report.
Women gathered in Côte-de-Neige Tuesday night to celebrate Black History Month with a Haitian dance lesson. Hosted by Femme du Monde, attendees learned about the history and various styles of dance in Haiti and enjoyed a mini-documentary by Haitian Montrealer Nitze Matelier called Kaschen. Dance instructor Tika from Bouche Cow led the group through the Congo dance, one of several styles of dance in Haiti.
Workshops for me bring people together. It's exactly what Haitian people brings people together, a lot of joys. I don't know if you realize, like, from the beginning to the end, everybody was laughing, the movement, everybody was working together, and it was a teamwork too. I just love the ambiance, the fact that everybody is full of joy. You know, it's a moment that you forget everything you have, like every problems you have outside. It's just about joy, dance, drums, learning.
Haitian dance, song, and drumming encompasses a wide variety of styles. They not only celebrate Haiti's rich cultural heritage, but also serve as a form of resistance and storytelling, encapsulating the resilience and joy of the Haitian people who practiced song and dance during colonial slavery. Attendees remarked on how much they learned about the powerful practice and about its current significance to Haitian Montrealers.
What's really stood out for me was how the dance is really close to nature in ways like how they're bare feet and they like to dance on the earth. And it seems just very natural way of dancing and the beat of the drums.
Mais sinon, par rapport à l'événement d'aujourd'hui, le côté un peu plus historique que ma collègue a amené de la danse, je trouvais que ça a donné vraiment, ça a rajouté vraiment une dimension de comme comprendre un peu qu'est-ce qu'on est en train de faire puis la culture derrière ça aussi.
Krishna Pierre from Femme du Monde told CJLO about other events they've held for Black History Month this year.
Alors, en fait, ce qu'on a fait comme activité, on a fait un atelier pour raconter en fait l'histoire des Noirs ici au Québec et au Canada. Donc c'était un atelier qui a été fait dans notre espace même, à nos locaux. Puis par la suite, samedi dernier, le 24 février, on a fait un salon d'un jour. Donc on a invité les femmes noires, en fait, nos membres femmes noires, à venir se faire coiffer gratuitement par des coiffeuses. Donc elles se sont fait coiffer. Donc c'était une journée spa, détente, coiffure.
Malaika from Femme du Monde, a dancer herself, explained how powerful dance can be to bring people together.
Donc normalement c'est moi qui donne des cours de danse et relaxation à peu près une ou deux fois par mois. Puis j'ai trouvé ça vraiment le fun de voir une autre façon aussi d'enseigner des cours pour les femmes c'est toujours dans le plaisir, puis je vois toujours comment les femmes adorent participer, puis ça, c'est juste comme très libérateur. Mais c'est ça, moi aussi, j'ai trouvé ça vraiment essentiel de donner aussi le contexte historique de d'où ça vient, les danses traditionnelles haïtiennes.
If you want to learn more about Haitian dancing or cultural events in Côte de Neige, check out Tika's Instagram page at Boujkow, B-O-O-G-K-O-W, or visit Femme de Mon on Facebook or on the web. In Montreal for CJLO, I'm Katie Brady.
A vigil is being held tonight to mourn the loss of Nax Benedict, the Two-Spirit Oklahoma teen who was beaten to death by students for identifying as non-binary. The vigil will be held at Cabot Square tonight at 6:30. All are welcome to hold space for BIPOC queer youth and for justice for Indigenous children. Tomorrow, a community health fair will be happening all day from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Monkland Community Center. There will be presenters, community organization kiosks, workshops on mental health, reimagining self-care, ageism, gender-affirming care, and more. So for more info, just check out the event on Facebook held by the Centre Eva Marsden at Monkland Community Center tomorrow. And I want to highlight something else this morning. A couple days ago, 50 mayors in Quebec signed a petition urging the provincial government to make a serious investment into public transit, a system that is essential for a more sustainable and accessible future. In recent years, transit funding has been falling more and more on the municipalities, but the signatories of the Union des Municipalités de Québec insist that new projects will not happen without provincial financial support. But this fall, Quebec announced its biggest private investment in the province's history, the electric vehicle battery industry. There are $7 billion going into the construction of a factory that will make lithium-ion batteries used in electric vehicles from start to finish, including mining, assembling, and recycling the batteries after use. You may have heard of the Swedish company Northvolt. This is the company that is building the battery plant 30 kilometers east of Montreal in the towns of McMasterville and Saint-Basile-le-Grand. So after the break, we'll be hearing from Lancelot Rodrigue from the School of Urban Planning at McGill. His niche is in systems of transportation and specifically how the urban planning decisions we make not only shape our world physically, but have deep social impacts. So if you're tuning in from the bus, the metro, most likely your car, this one's for you. So we're going to take a quick break right now. You're listening to The Get Up on CJLO Radio, 6090 AM with your host, Julia. It's 9:12 and it's minus 8 outside. Stay tuned.
Louis Dafford presents two exceptional events in Montreal. The virtuoso Gambian choral player Sonu Jabarte on March 8th at the National, and the iconic Malian singer Umo Sangare on April 21st at MTELUS. Take advantage of a special offer by visiting festivalnuitdafrique.com.
Oh, Bakalanga.
Lily.
peux passer un peu par le temps. Par-ci, par-là. Par-ci, par-ci, par-là. Pepper Street. Petite poignée à peau. Fais pas percuter. Pas que ça t'empomme.
We're back. You're listening to The Get Up, CJLO Radio, 1690 AM. It is 9:25 AM, and I'm your host, Julia. We're excited to get back into it today. We just heard Iki. Well, the first one was Iki, Silurize, Stifia by Acid Arab, and this last one was Pam Segara, Les Amis au Pakistan. That one always gets me a good laugh. And I just want to remind everybody that it's Rina's birthday, just in case Rina's listening to the show tonight. So we're back and we're talking about transportation today and how the way we move around shapes our lives, not only physically, but socially too. I'm sure many of you are on the move right now. Let's talk about daily commute times to work. The average commute time for Canadians on bikes, motorcycles, and cars is around 20 to 25 minutes, but the average time for those of us taking public transit is 43 minutes. That's double. And commute times add up. Studies show that longer commutes have impacts on mental health, safety, and finance, so we turn to cars when we can. And in May 2023, studies found that 1.3 million Montrealers commuted to work by car. And just a few months ago, as I said before, Quebec invested in a multi-billion dollar electric vehicle battery plant. This is a big project, and some call it the future. But for those wanting real investment in Quebec's public transit system, this is not hopeful news. A couple days ago, 50 mayors in Quebec signed a petition urging the CAQ for a serious investment into public transport. So let's talk about car culture and transportation with Lancelot Rodrigue. Lancelot is a transport researcher at McGill's School of Urban Planning with a background in geography as well. Lancelot, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, for sure. Welcome on the show. So when we connected earlier, I asked you what draws you to your research, and you told me that you're interested in the decisions that we make as a society that shape our world. Can you paint us a picture of what that means and explain some of your research?
Well, yeah, the main element that I'm really interested in is that I think fundamentally, when we think about big projects, big infrastructure, how we organize our cities, we don't necessarily realize just how long the impacts will be lasting and for how many generations. So for me, what's really driving my research is understanding in the past the decision that we made that impacted how we live now and how can we shape the future of how we're going to live our daily lives later on by shaping how we organize our cities, the public transportation system that we're putting forth. So, and I think fundamentally what it goes to is that in order to, if I go really into my interest in transportation, in order to get around, you need to have places to go. So you need to have different lane usage to go to. But in order to be able to have a public transportation networking, you also need to be able to have these investments, have the support of different political levels. The main interest for me is really all of these different interacting factors of political interest and also long-lasting impacts that we can have on our cities.
Thank you for that. Speaking of political interests, but maybe on a little historical perspective, let's talk about the history of transit in Quebec. How much is car culture, as we call this, embedded into our society? Because, you know, compared to older countries like in Europe and the Middle East, we're looking around, it seems as though Canadian cities were built with cars in mind. Is that even true?
Well, it is to a certain extent, but like we have to look back a bit like 100 years ago. If we look at the start of the 20th century, there was like a lot more focus on public transit, particularly in Montreal. Streetcars were present. There was a good network of streetcars. People were mostly moving around with these. It's really after World War II that car culture really started expanding with a big infrastructure boom, big investment in highways, and that really shaped the last 70, 80 years. So it's really when we started seeing like a lot of shift from community or public transportation to really individualized perception of transportation. So in that sense, we really saw a shift where the priority was put onto cars first and foremost above everybody else, and all other road users became secondary. So it's been embedded for the last 70, 80 years, but there's still remnants in our cities that are indicative of like previous focus on public transportation, active transportation. So there's still room to do so, but like many other North American cities, the big growth that's been done in the cities, the suburbs and everything, it's really been done with car in mind. So there's a really predominant car culture that is, yes, embedded in Canadian cities.
And when we're talking about car culture, for those who don't know, we're talking about a big reliance on cars. What does that really mean exactly?
Yeah, well, it primarily means that it's not necessarily that people are in love with cars. It's just that you need to have a car across most Canadian cities for a lot of people. If you're not really in the downtown core, or the really central areas in big cities, you need to have a car to be able to move around, to be able to do your daily tasks or daily activities. And it's not necessarily that it is a choice that you want to do, because people don't even perceive that they have a choice. It's a necessity. So everything is shaped for you to move around by car. All the destinations are, most of them will have parking lots. So it's really just shaping people not having a choice in how they get around and being forced to use a car.
Right. What is Quebec's history of investment into transit now? Like, did transit used to be better when less people had cars, or when we're talking before the boom around the Second World War?
Well, again, like transit was, the service was at the moment really meant to get people to and from work, whereas now we're understanding that there's a lot more nuance in how people move around. So I would say at that time, the service was probably ideal for the type of trips that people were doing. But nowadays, like, we need to integrate the fact that people will have hobbies, they'll be moving for other purposes. But also in terms of history of investments, we in Quebec, we've seen that there was a boom with, like, the metro in Montreal for the Olympics, but it really halted, like, in the mid-80s. And then we had another, again, like, in 2000 with, like, the extension to Laval. And then since then, it's only been the REM pretty much and nothing else. So the investments have been pretty scarce, and it's usually a big investment every 10 to 20 years and then nothing in between.
Okay, so the amount of investments they're making is not really indicative of how much more we're moving as a society. It's just...
No, not really. It's like, I would say these investments, the best example would be if we contrast it for, like, some European cities, or for instance, Paris, which is building, like, new metro stations every year. So every year there's not as much of a big investment, but it's so sustained through time that when you look at a longer period of time, there's a lot more that's been invested to further public transit. Whereas here, it's no one's doing anything for the longest part. And then at one point, it's like, okay, we need to do something because we need to catch up. So we'll do a big, big project. And then it'll be very controversial because no one has been used to have this kind of project for like 10, 20 years. And it'll be hard to get through. And then once it's done, people will be like, okay, we don't touch it anymore for another 10 to 20 years because that was too difficult.
Mm-hmm. I mean, how are we doing compared to other provinces like Ontario, for example? Why is there not investment, I guess, is the obvious question here.
Well, yeah, compared to Ontario, I would say Quebec is doing pretty poorly, very poorly, actually. If we just compare Toronto and Montreal, Toronto has many, many rapid transit projects that are online that are actually in the works and being built, whereas in Montreal, we have the REM, but that's pretty much it. And, like, all the other projects that have been put forth have been studied and going back to the drawing board. So the main elements behind that, I think, is really down to the politicization of transportation project. I think in Ontario, they have much more, they have separated the transportation projects a lot more from politics. So it's really like planners, transportation planners, urban planners that are working to do these projects, that have the means to do them, and that have the respect from the provincial government to do so. Whereas in Quebec, we don't have that as much. There's not as much respect for public transit agencies or the regional agencies to plan for these projects, and not as much, they don't have as much power to do so. And so we have a lot more of integration of politics into projects, which makes them much more controversial and much more difficult to apply.
Mm-hmm. I want to come back to this, public perception, even like the priorities of governments and decision making like this. But I also want to come back to car culture and the social effects, because you told me earlier when we connected that there are a lot of things we don't realize about how living our lives very reliant on cars makes us feel. What are the social impacts?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of time with something that people don't often think about is just when you're commuting by car, you're usually not taking in your surrounding as much as if you're in public transit or if you're walking, if you're cycling. So you're interacting less with people, you're interacting less with your environment. So all that you're seeing is just other car, which is very dehumanizing. So you're not having as much of an experience with being able to appreciate the landscape, being able to have interactions with people. So it creates an environment that is much more dehumanized, and sometimes that can lead people to feeling isolated as well. So that's something that often is not thought about in terms of social impacts of car culture. And aside from that, there's also all the elements that goes with health impacts, the elements of, like, you're not moving, you're sitting down in your car maybe for 2 hours, being in traffic, whereas if you were taking public transit or walking, you would be doing some physical activity, which would be good as well for your mental health. So these are really kind of insidious effects of car culture that often we kind of forget about because it's so omnipresent in our lives.
Mm-hmm. Because cars are branded so much as freedom. You know, if you have a car, you can go anywhere, anytime. You're more free, but I guess that's not completely true in some cases.
Well, it's a bit paradoxical because it's free solely in the context that we are in, where you need to have a car to move around. But in context that you would not need to have a car to move around, a lot of people wouldn't choose cars because they're metaphorically, like, they're a cage in which you put yourself to move around. You're not interacting with people. So they're free simply because we made them to be, because in the society in which we live in, you need to have a car, but should you not need to have a car, the same idea would probably not be present.
Right, I hear that. So I don't know if you've been following much of the Northvolt project out in McMasterville and Saint-Basile-le-Grand. What is your impression, just in general, of the impact that investing into electric vehicle battery production will have?
Well, I would say from starting with the positive, the main thing with EVs and electric vehicles is really like the main goal is to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the transportation sector on the long term. So that's a positive element to add to that. But otherwise, the main problem that I have often when people are talking about electric vehicles is that they're framing it as being the one solution to all problems in transportation. But the reality is that whether it's a gas car, an electric car, an autonomous car, it really doesn't change anything to the individualized vision of transportation in the city that we have that's stemming from car culture. All of these type of cars are still going to get caught in traffic. So it's fundamentally not just replacing the type of car that we need, but it's reducing the number of personal vehicles on the roads to allow for the reconversion of really car-centric environment to be at the human scale, to allow people to allow space for other modes of transportation. So yes, batteries production will be good from a greenhouse gas emission standpoint, but it's not going to solve all problems that we would have in terms of transportation.
Right. Something that did decrease, I guess, ridership, even on the roads, was COVID. I know we all don't like to go back to the pandemic, but it happened. And it really put a pressure on the public transit system. I'm wondering, in your perspective, how did the public transit system in Quebec cope with that major decrease in ridership?
It's still, I would say, probably not very well. Like, we're still coping with it in the sense that we're still hovering around like 70-80% of pre-pandemic levels, which means that like the revenues that we're getting from the fares and like people paying to use public transit are down still, which has led to a lot of issues with shortages, which is a big problem because the more if you can't make your budget, you need to have to cut somewhere. And if you cut in service, you're going to further affect ridership, which is going to lead to a further cut in service, which goes into a downward loop. So the main issues with COVID, it's really that it's put a big strain on public transit finances. And there's not necessarily a lot of attention being put from the provincial government into actually filling that shortage. They're more trying to argue about what's the nature of the shortage, whether they're trying to fill it and ensure that public transit will be able to continue running.
Mm-hmm. I know in some places, in some cities in North America, they've done studies, or they did at the time of COVID, to see where the demand was highest for public transportation. Did Montreal, did Quebec do that? What kind of services were cut, and maybe are there still areas, for example, that have less services now?
Yeah, well, in Montreal, actually, like, there's one city that looked at 40 cities across North America, and what they found was that Montreal didn't do much cut, but where they tended to cut was more in lower-income areas than higher-income areas. That's not necessarily voluntary, but that's an outcome of, like, the cuts that were done, maybe because they weren't careful to look at these elements. And at the moment, there are still issues where you have really expensive routes to run that are going maybe to the West Island or that are running like just in the downtown core that are still running, but that are not necessarily serving people that need them the most. But you'll have really busy bus lines that are running on big arteries in Montreal that are very much used by a lot of lower-income people that are going to work. And these were heavily cut because they were the most, they were the easier one to give cuts because they were the one that had the most frequency because they were the one that was the most used. So there's still issues in trying to rectify the service to reflect the usage of people and to promote increased equity. But that's a task that's really still to be done.
And when we spoke earlier, you told me that at the end of the day, and this is something pretty central to your research, is that what impacts transport most is the public's perception of it and the its projects, people's experience using it. So we're in a moment of increasing public distrust in the government, to say the least. Tell us how public perception plays a role currently.
Yes, I think, public perceptions are really like what people experience at the end of the day regarding a project, regarding a public transit when they're using it. So you can try to make the service as good as possible. If people don't perceive it as being good, they're not going to continue using it. Or if you do a project and you, if we take the example with the Norval, if you do a project and you don't necessarily want to go to the BAP or like do the environmental assessment, even if it's or in the perspective of trying to really push for a better change, it gives the impression of a lack of transparency, of lack of respecting processes, and people are pushing back even more with that. We saw that as well in Montreal with the Hem de l'Est, which was kind of similar issues, and people are really pushing back with the idea of trying to bypass due process and bypass public consultations and not have transparency, because exactly in the moment that we're right now, there's a lot of distrust, and it's really, really crucial if we want to be able to have public transit or projects that work, that are actually implemented, to take a bit more time, follow process, and include different actors, be transparent to make sure that we really build trust in the institutions, so that we, on the long term, we can continue and really ramp up the implementation of new public transit infrastructure.
Right. So you're saying that this also played a role in the REM project, for example. That did they do a BAP for that one?
For the REM project, yes, they did do a BAP, which the main recommendation was actually to not build the projects, and that there were other alternatives that would be more beneficial, and that would cost less and have less of an impact on the environment and on social aspects as well. But this was disregarded. So that was a big issue as well for the project, which led to a lot of people being angry and frustrated again with the project, which doesn't really lead to a good impression when it's the really first big transportation project in a really long time in Quebec.
Right. Yeah. Some local residents, as well as Quebecers broadly, feel a deep sense of lack of transparency in this REM case, and in also the case of the Northvolt battery plant project. And for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, the BAP, the BAPE, is an environmental regulations test. It assessed the risk. It holds public consultations, I guess. But consultation is an interesting word in this sense. As you say, even when a BAP is completed, it's not necessarily going to change the end result of a project. It still probably will go through. Why is the transparency of public perception if the public perception is so crucial to the success of big projects like these, why aren't the government or, you know, companies that are constructing these taking this more into account? Wouldn't it just be way less of a headache?
Well, that's kind of a paradox, that they have the perception themselves that they need to go faster. They need to bypass these elements to go faster, to be able to do the project as they want. In the case of the REM, was to do a project that would be lucrative for the promoter. But the main issue is that these, again, are perspectives that come from people that are not acquainted with public transportation planning or urban planning, because when you know a bit more about the field, you know that this is actually the wrong way to go about it, and it's actually going to hurt your chance of implementing a project in the long term. But because it comes from maybe more of a private angle, there's this perception again of, we don't need to do public consultation, we know how to do the project, we'll do it our way, and let's not consult with everybody else. But the reality is that when you're doing urban planning or transportation planning, you need to consult different actors, because what you're working on is a major societal project that has impact on a lot of different people. And if you want to make sure to have the best project possible and the most efficient one, it goes with working with different actors to do so.
Mm-hmm. So back to public transit investment, maybe to lead off on a higher note, or maybe not. 50 municipal mayors in Quebec are calling for the government to invest in public transit. And this is coming a few days before the Minister of Finance is going to announce the CAQ's budget. Do you think that investing in public transit aligns with the priorities of the current government? If not, what what strategies are necessary to invest and to shift away from car culture?
Well, I would say in terms of priorities, I wouldn't be able really to assess that, because sometimes it looks like it is, sometimes it looks like it's not. It's been going a bit back and forth. But it's sure in the prospect, if they want to put kind of a green transition as a big element of their platform, then yes, investing in public transit is crucial. And it's about securing funds for transit agencies, for municipalities to provide the service right now so that they can increase service to have an impact right away on people, and also having a clear long-term plan and like clear investments, larger project to start doing now and to start planning for in the future. And this all boils down mainly to being able to go and depoliticize public transit projects. So it will be interesting to see if the new provincial agency that's in the work for a public transit project would allow to achieve that, because that would be really a big element of being able to depoliticize public transit projects if we really want to be able to move away from car culture in the future.
Right. Well, thank you so much for talking to us today, Lancelot. That was Lancelot Rodrigue on car culture. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
So we're going to take a little break after this. You're listening to The Get Up on CJLO 1690 AM. It is currently 9:48 AM. We're almost coming up on the end of our show, but we're going to listen to some ads, do some music, and I'll be back for a final note at the end. Stay tuned.
Sound is proud to present Shada Hayes. Discover the country folk of singer-songwriter Shada Hayes with Kindergarten Heart, an album as fun as it is profound. Available now on CD and colored vinyl. Shada Hayes will perform at Le Ministère on April 4th for the Kindergarten Heart record release show, sharing stage with her band and surprise guests. Tickets are on sale now. For more information and for all tour dates, go to bonesound.com.
De gasoline, je montrerai toutes les belles collines. Quand la noirceur sera venue, j'allumerai les lumières pour ma vie et je roulerai dans la nuit en chantant ces jolies mélodies. J'ai passé une belle nuit à Québec en te caressant avec des beaux becs. J'ai passé une belle nuit à Ottawa en te caressant, en te tenant dans mes bois. J'ai passé une belle nuit à Toronto. Mais si je me rappelle bien, ça fermait un petit peu trop tôt. Attention, Toronto. Je suis un Hells Angels à pied. Je roule la vie sur du papier. Je mange des hot dogs mais je bois du thé. Je suis un Satan's Choice raté. Pour faire comme les vrais robineux, je m'achète des beaux vieux habineux. Je suis un bon de bonne famille. Quand je vois sa main, je mange des gâteries. Et quand je fonce vers la lune, c'est bien assis en Volkswagen avec ma brune. J'aurais trop peur sur un chopper avec Aline pour vu que ça pine, avec Thérèse, fraise contre fraise. Faut pas que ça niaise. Si j'avais les ailes d'un ange, je partirais pour
Québec.
Si j'avais des lumières sur mon bac, je partirais pour
Québec.
Si j'avais plus de gasoline, je montrais toutes les belles collines. Quand la noirceur sera venue, j'allumerai les lumières pour ma vie. Et je roulerai dans la nuit. So when the twilight falls on the heights, I will light my lights for my sight. Et je roulerai dans la nuit. En rechantant ces jolies mélodies, j'ai passé ma belle nuit à Québec. En te caressant avec des beaux becs. J'ai passé une belle nuit à Ottawa. En te caressant, en tenant dans mes bois. J'ai passé une belle nuit à Toronto. Mais si je me rappelle bien, ça fermait un petit peu trop tôt. Oh oui, mais si j'avais les ailes d'un ange, je partirais pour
Québec. Québec. Québec.
Well, you're listening to The Get Up on CJLO 1690 AM. I'm your host, Julia. Usually we've got Lior Scherzer with us, but she'll be back next week. Stay tuned with us every Friday morning for all of your news, talk, and music of your Friday morning. We were just listening to Les Ailes d'un Ange by Robert Charlebois. Right now, we're going to be listening to Gina Birch's I Play My Bass Loud, which I hope you do. And we'll be closing out the show. It's 9:53 a.m., and thanks for listening. See you next time.
I play my bass loud. Let's
I trust the process.